This morning's graduation ceremony is, of course, a group graduation. The entire 1982 graduating class from the university is assembling here this morning to share their celebration. This afternoon, there will be department activities, and the various university departments will be hosting ceremonies and receptions throughout the campus. Many of them are beginning at 1 o'clock this afternoon, and several beginning at 2 o'clock. The graduates are still being seated. We can look forward to two speeches this morning. Dr. Louis A. Kozer, the Distinguished Professor of Sociology at Stony Brook, is going to speak. He is the past president of the American Sociological Association and has co-authored with Charles Kadushin and Walter Powell the recently published books, The Culture and Commerce of Publishing. And Eric Corley will be the student speaker at today's ceremony. Eric Corley is a graduating senior. He is the program director for WUSB-FM. And we can look forward to both Dr. Kozer's and Eric Corley's speech this morning. In the background, the processional being performed by the Long Island Brass Guild. We are broadcasting live the 22nd graduation exercises ceremony from the campus of the State University of New York at Stony Brook. It is a chilly and overcast morning, this May 23rd. But the good feelings and good cheer that surrounds today's ceremonies negate the negative weather. A lot of smiles, a lot of very happy people. Today's ceremony, of course, is a celebration for the graduates who are completing their studies with today's exercises. It's also a celebration for the university. Of course, you know the State University of New York is the public university center for Long Island and metropolitan New York. The Stony Brook campus was established in 1957, and the university has grown to enroll more than 16,000 students. The internationally distinguished faculty of 1,250 members last year attracted more than $31 million in external research support. And the campus, with 98 buildings on 1,000 acres, houses 100 academic departments and interdisciplinary programs. The major academic units consist of the College of Arts and Sciences, the College of Engineering and Applied Sciences, the W. Averill Harriman College for Urban and Policy Sciences, the Graduate School, the Center for Continuing Education, and the Health Sciences Center's five schools for the training of physicians and other healthcare professionals. The 540-bed University Hospital began phasing in its operations in 1980, offering modern facilities for patient care and research, as well as instruction. The Fine Arts Center here at Stony Brook offers a year-round program of concerts and recitals, theater performances, art exhibits, and other events that are open to the public. The university's scholarly collections, which exceed 1.25 million bound volumes and an additional 1.6 million items in microformat, are housed in the Frank Melville Jr. Memorial Library, the Health Sciences Library, and the five major branches. I'd like to read to you the message from Dr. John Mauberger, the president of the State University of New York at Stony Brook, that can be found in today's commencement brochure. He writes, "Leadership is much admired, but little emulated. Is that because great leaders are so remote and rare that their behavior seems beyond our own capacities? Is it because we mistake aggressiveness for leadership and reject it as incompatible with our own personalities or ideals? Or is there some deep-seated instinct for social order that suppresses the will to leadership in us when we encounter it in others? I believe the reason is that most of us are simply unaware of our own leadership potential and of society's vast need for it. To become a leader, you need only accept responsibility for the improvement of the tiny part of the world that you live in and understand. No one gives you that responsibility, and no one defines clearly how it is that you will discharge it. No one even expects that you will accept it, because so few ever do. And because such behavior is rare, it is often regarded with suspicion and attributed to ulterior motives. The great and simple fact is, however, that there is no other way that things get done in this world. By studying the behavior of real people reacting to real events, we learn that doing one's job is by no means the same as accepting responsibility for seeing that the job gets done. We also learn that the jobs we need to do to achieve any broad objective are highly ambiguous, and that complex projects require personal initiative and a personal sense of responsibility at every level if they are to succeed. I am suggesting that what it takes to become a leader is no different than what it takes to do anything well, an unconditional willingness to accept total responsibility. Now that you know how simple it is, do it. The world needs your help." That's a message that can be found in today's commencement program by Dr. John H. Mauberger, the president of the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Thank you. As the graduates continue to take their seats, and we still have some time, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the attire that the graduates are wearing. The costume of those in the academic procession has a specific symbolism which dates back to at least the 14th century. Academic institutions in the United States adopted a code of academic dress in 1895, which has been revised from time to time. The dress of institutions in other countries varies, and there is not a worldwide code, but the basic elements are present in all academic costumes. The bachelor's gown has long and pointed sleeves. The master's gown has an oblong sleeve open at the wrist, or some older gowns may be open near the upper part of the arm. And the doctor's gown is fuller than the others, with velvet panels full length on the front and three velvet crossbars on each sleeve in back or in the color distinctive of the subject to which the owner's degree pertains. The gowns are black except for the doctor's, which in a few instances are of a color representing the institution which conferred the degree. The hood, draped over the shoulders and down the back, indicates the subject to which the degree pertains and the university that conferred the degree. The level of the degree is indicated by the size of the hood. The hood for the bachelor's degree is 3 feet long, for the master's it is 3.5 feet long, and for the doctor's it is 4 feet long. The binding of the hood is of colored velvet designating the subject of the degree, and it is 2 inches, 3 inches, and 5 inches wide for the bachelor's, master's, and doctor's degrees, respectively. The colors associated with some of the subjects are as follows: arts, letters, humanities, white; economics, copper; education, light blue; medicine, green; philosophy, dark blue; social work, science, golden yellow; public administration, peacock blue. The lining of the hood is of the color or colors of the institution conferring the degree. The lining of the doctor's hood is revealed more than in the master's hood, and much less of the lining is revealed in the bachelor's hood. As far as the caps are concerned, in the United States, the black mortarboard is most commonly used. The tassel fastened to the center of the cap is normally worn in the left front quadrant of the cap and is black, although it may be of the color appropriate to the subject of the degree. The tassel for the doctor's cap may be of gold thread. Some interesting information about the academic attire that the nearly 4,000 graduates at the State University of New York at Stony Brook are wearing this morning. Graduates assembled at various staging and robing areas this morning that are located primarily in the academic mall area of the campus, which is a bit of a walk to the graduation ceremony site. And with that many thousands of people involved, it obviously is taking a bit of time to move from one place to the other. For those of you in the radio audience, I'd like to remind you that you are listening to the 22nd graduation exercises ceremony broadcast live from the athletic field here on the campus of the State University of New York at Stony Brook. You are tuned to 90.1 FM WUSB Stony Brook. I'd like to read to you a message from Kirk Kelly, who is the senior class representative of the undergraduate body here at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Kirk Kelly writes, "Our time here has been a learning experience, not only academically, but in all aspects of Stony Brook life. We have set our hearts and our minds towards bettering ourselves, and out of those efforts have come the good times we have had, the friends we have made, and all the things which now make leaving difficult. But in leaving, there are things we must keep in mind which go beyond the clichés we often associate with graduation. First, we must remember the place from which we received our education. Just as we have grown over the past few years, so too has the State University of New York at Stony Brook. As we have all tried to better ourselves individually, collectively, we have contributed to the growth of this institution. Now that we are graduating, much of Stony Brook's future development will rely on what we make of the opportunity with which we have been presented. Secondly, we must remember that we have been educated not only for our own sake. We have all followed different courses of study, which in varying degrees will benefit us in our search for employment, but the main purpose of our education was to make us more aware of the problems of today's world and to provide us with some of the insight needed to approach those problems. We leave Stony Brook at a time in which there is a great need for an educated population, yet at the same time it is becoming more difficult to obtain an education. With this great demand for educated people, it is important that we keep ourselves aware of where our education will do the most good. And as we approach the challenges of the future, there is good cause to be anxious. To meet these challenges, we must be able to use our knowledge, to learn from our experiences, to share our knowledge with those who can benefit from it. We must never stop striving to better ourselves and our society. That is a message from Kirk Kelly, the senior class representative of the student government, the undergraduate student government here at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. That message can be found in the very beautiful brochure and program that marks the 22nd commencement here at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. As I mentioned earlier, there will be 30 departmental activities taking place after the central ceremony. Six speakers will take part in departmental activities. Among them are Dr. Rose Kozer of Stony Brook Sociology Department, who will address that department's graduates at 1 p.m. David Dellinger of the War Resisters League and Mobilization for Survival will speak at the School of Social Welfare ceremony at 12:30 p.m. And Dr. Ivan L. Bennett, who is the Dean of New York University School of Medicine, will speak at the ceremonies at the School of Medicine. There will be other departmental ceremonies that are scheduled for June the 6th, 13th, and 27th. These activities will range from gatherings of 25 to over 1,000 people and will provide an opportunity for presentation of departmental awards and honors. Dr. Leon Eisenbud, who is a professor of oral biology and chairman of the Department of Dentistry at Long Island Jewish Hillside Medical Center, will speak at the School of Dental Medicine ceremony on June the 6th. And on June the 13th, Margaret O'Neill, the executive director of the Pilgrim Psychiatric Center, will speak at the School of Nursing ceremony. And Dr. Frank Reisman, who is the co-director of the National Self-Help Clearinghouse, will speak at the School of Allied Health Profession ceremony, which is slated for June 27th. And those of you who are USB listeners know that June 27th also is a celebration for the radio station. June 27th marks 5 years of FM broadcasting for WUSB Stony Brook. It is not quite rain that is falling on us. I don't know what it is. Thank you. For those of you just tuning in, I'd like to remind you that this is Norm Pruslin, and we are on the athletic field of the State University of New York at Stony Brook as we get ready to begin the presentation of awards and speeches that mark the 22nd commencement here at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. In the background, you hear the processional, and the processional began at about 10:30 this morning. It's taking quite a bit of time for the graduates to be seated. There are over 4,000 graduates who will be graduating from the State University of New York at Stony Brook, and they are all marching in to take their seats. To read to you another message from Dr. John Mauberger, the president of the State University of New York at Stony Brook. This is to the candidates for graduation, their families and friends. Dr. Mauberger writes, 1982 marks the 25th anniversary of the State University of New York at Stony Brook and the 20th year of development of the Stony Brook campus at its present site. Each of those years has seen enormous change, and each new graduating class has had a distinctive experience which continues to enrich the lives and careers of each of its members. To celebrate this experience and affirm its importance in our lives, we encourage your participation in our 22nd commencement ceremony. Traditionally, for students who have fulfilled the requirements for academic degrees, commencement at Stony Brook allows the entire university community to measure annually its extraordinary progress in building a distinguished university. At Stony Brook, our mood of optimism contrasts auspiciously with grim forecasts of future national circumstances. We are preparing here a generation of men and women who have the confidence, the knowledge, and the skills to endure such difficult times and to build beyond them toward a stronger society. Please join us to commemorate their accomplishments and to encourage their aspirations. Sincerely, John Mauberger, President of the State University of New York at Stony Brook. We have another message from Leonard Spivak, who is the president of the Stony Brook Alumni Association. This message is also found in the brochure and program for today's commencement activities. Leonard Spivak writes, "Today's commencement marks a turning point in the lives of each of you. The very word commencement signifies not an end, but the beginning of an exciting period of new opportunities, challenges, and responsibilities which await you as you leave behind your Stony Brook student status and enter the ranks of our alumni. You came to Stony Brook to obtain an education. Your presence here today marks the achievement of that specific goal. There can be no doubt, moreover, that each of you has grown through your experiences at Stony Brook in ways which you will be as important to you as the formal degree you have earned. All of you, even those who will not continue your formal education beyond today's ceremonies, will continue to learn through life's experiences. As you look back over your years at Stony Brook, you will have many memories. Perhaps the most important of these memories will be the people you have known here. My strongest and fondest memories of Stony Brook are of the outstanding men and women I came to know as a student, many of whom I continue to meet. Just as Stony Brook has matured as an institution, its graduates have over the years come to achieve distinction in innumerable fields of endeavor. I welcome you among their number. On behalf of the Alumni Association, I congratulate you on the occasion of this commencement and offer our sincere best wishes for a future you can live in with peace and pride. We invite each of you to continue your involvement with Stony Brook through membership in the association and participation in the association's activities. A message from Leonard Spivak, graduate of 1964. He is the president of the Stony Brook Alumni Association. Dr. R. Christian Anderson, who is the chairman of the Council of the State University of New York at Stony Brook, also has a message that can be found in today's program. He writes, on behalf of the Stony Brook Council, I offer best wishes and warm congratulations on the attainment of your degree. You will now come to see in more direct ways that knowledge is power, hopefully not the kind of power that corrupts. And while learning does convey strength and provides reassuring perspectives, its possession extracts or should require certain responsibilities. For example, Jonathan Schell, in his recent alarm about nuclear weapons, concludes that knowledge is the deterrent. He seems to despair in this. I do not. If we, as we have, harness the power, we ought to be able to control it. This is not the time to lose our nerve about the power of knowledge. Science does help with understanding consequences. Technology has materially advanced the human condition. Not too long ago, an editorial writer, musing on this perplexing age, commented that scientists must have great courage to enter their laboratories each day armed only with knowledge. Pray tell, I would ask, what else is there? What else is more appropriate to guide our course, control our behavior, relieve our fears? Knowledge properly employed is essential. We salute you on this, your commencement. Enlarge upon the education you have received at Stony Brook. Put it to good effect, remembering that we are all in a small bark on a large sea. That's a message from Dr. R. Christian Anderson, the chairman of the Council of the State University of New York at Stony Brook. The platform guests have arrived at the front row and are beginning to take their places on the stage. We are nearly ready to begin the 1982 graduation exercises for the State University of New York at Stony Brook. In a moment, the 1982 commencement ceremony will begin.
Dr. Anderson, the commencement may now begin. It is a great pleasure to welcome you today for the 22nd commencement exercises of the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Will you please remain standing and join the members of the University Chorale Society and the Long Island Brass Guild for the national anthem? And will you remain standing for the invocation, which will be delivered by the Reverend Robert Smith, the chaplaincy director?
O Holy One, when we stand consciously in the mystery of your presence, we find ourselves in the presence of the mystery of one another. Sometimes mute before the enormity and scandal of human pain, sometimes, as today, delighted by human accomplishment, the delight of learning, the satisfaction of jobs done, the poignant joy of beginnings whose surely different endings none of us knows and only some of us will see. Why do we speak of you at all here, of whom so many of us find only silence to be a truthful, honest, and human attitude, when we haven't time to speak adequately of what we can say and see in each other? If to reach toward you is to plunge toward the depth of ourselves and to break the limits of our language and our ordinary world, then prayer belongs here, whatever its awkwardness. Today we celebrate work, accomplishment, the beginnings of careers, and we do this celebrating in rituals which remind us that we belong to that community of thinkers and scholars and workers that stretches back for hundreds of years, for thousands of human lives. O Holy One, I invoke your presence in this place of human accomplishment, because we do not easily know that the final development of the individual comes in discovering and in creating our connectedness with others. Awaken in the depth of our imagination today a sense of our real self, a suspicion of the truth of our destiny, beyond our possibility to express it, in the face of what separates and threatens us in each other. Awaken in us the suspicion that it is in one another and in you that we live and move and have our being.
Ladies and gentlemen, please be seated. I am privileged to introduce my colleagues on the Council of the State University of New York. Good friends, will you stand as I call your names, please? Leonard Eichenholz, Donald Jaffin, Dr. Greta Rainsford, Nina Townsend, and Andrew Ullman. Thank you very much. Let me continue with the introduction of certain of the distinguished guests on the platform. I first wish to introduce the assemblymen from the 2nd District of the State of New York, which includes the Stony Brook campus, the Honorable George J. Hochbruckner. I would like now to introduce members of the Board of Trustees of the State University of New York, Dr. John Holloman, and Mrs. Gretchen Siegel. This is the first time in 12 years that Stony Brook has conducted a central commencement exercise. It will not be the last. I am pleased to introduce a member of the graduating class who will bring us greetings from the student body. The speaker was chosen by a committee composed of students, faculty, and staff, and is receiving his bachelor's degree in English. He is from Stony Brook and is a graduate of the Ward Melville High School class of 1977. He has been active in university affairs, especially with the campus radio station, and has achieved marked success in his academic career. It is a pleasure to introduce Mr. Eric Corley.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to see everybody here on this fine autumn day. I want to thank everybody for coming, and I want to thank the university for putting on this wonderful event. They've done a very good job. Well, the weather's not their fault. I want to also thank the maintenance workers who wiped off 11,000 wet chairs this morning. I think they deserve a hand. Well, today marks a ceremonial occasion, an occasion of change that carries an assurance that tomorrow things just won't be the same anymore. I'm sure that within all of us there's a slight feeling of dread and certainly more than a little fear when we think about just what lies in the future. Well, there's nothing at all strange about this. We've been afraid of the future ever since we first developed the capacity to comprehend it. From the first day of nursery school to college graduation, anything that represents a change in our daily lives makes us nervous. But there's something about leaving college that's radically different from anything else we've ever done. For many of us, this day symbolizes something we thought about for a long time: entering the real world, the beginning of the rest of our lives. But what is this real world? Where is it? What is it like? And where does it begin? Is that it across the tracks? Is it in Port Jefferson or New York City or Plainview? One thing we seem able to agree upon, it's not like Stony Brook. Wherever this real world is, we won't find the kind of individual attention we've come to expect here. Some of us. There won't be hundreds of diverse organizations geared towards our specialized needs. And we'll never again be able to witness thousands of people from so many different races, religions, and backgrounds converging together in an atmosphere of harmony and cooperation. That is the world we've grown accustomed to here at Stony Brook. And it can't possibly be duplicated out there. But it seems to me as if we just might be coming down a bit too hard on the real world. After all, what is the real world? Aren't we a part of it? Haven't we always been? If so, then we should be able to take what we've learned here and apply it to this real world. Instead of fearing what's ahead, why not welcome it? Because what's ahead is us. Among the 4,000 or so of us graduating today, we're destined to travel to the four corners of the globe. And wherever we go, we'll take memories of Stony Brook with us. Well, I've got some favorites, memories of reading books under shady trees in the spring, waiting for buses outside the student union, sometimes for hours, long nights in the library, hall parties, Oktoberfests, ice cream sandwiches at 2 o'clock in the morning, the Fine Arts Center, and of course, that megastructure over there that some of us can see, a creation that can never be repeated. Some say that's fortunate. I'm not so sure. I think there's quite a bit of character in such a unique concoction. Stony Brook had its bad points. When I first came here, getting good grades wasn't the objective. It was finding a parking space. A good deal of the campus was still mud, and long lines in the administration building were almost an everyday occurrence. Well, since then, the mud has disappeared. Parking seems to have become easier. And there aren't as many long lines in the administration building. But even with these hindrances, Stony Brook still had a lot to offer us if we took the time to look around. You know, a university such as this is an ideal place for the individual. And I, for one, came to value individuality more than anything during my time here. I always knew that every person ever created was unique in some way. However, you tend to spot individuality more easily in a place like this where people are so obviously different. Difference is a theme of the human race, and so is conflict. And that conflict is based upon the differences among all the people who comprise this world in the first place. Differences in thought, differences in background, differences in religion, etc. In other words, differences in the very things that make us individuals. Thus, individuality could be said to be the cause of all of the problems in the world today. Maybe if we erased all of these unique traits, we'd be able to think logically and uniformly, and there wouldn't be any more problems. But then, there wouldn't be any more life. None that would be worth living. One of my favorite authors, John Stuart Mill, said in his writings on liberty, "Even despotism does not produce its worst effects, so long as individuality exists under it, and whatever crushes individuality is despotism, by whatever name it may be called, and whether it professes to be enforcing the will of God or the injunctions of men." What Mill said holds true in any age. At this moment, there are people, there are organizations, and there are governments that are trying to control and suppress individuals all over the world. They're doing this in the name of God, in the name of morality, and in the name of national interest. And we're by no means immune. Suppression is not a tactic that the leftists use, nor is it one of the right wing. It's found everywhere, in the old and the young, and in every race. The desire to suppress individuality knows no sides. It's an inherent negative trait of the human race, one that we have to learn to overcome. Remember, a world without individuals, a world where everyone thinks and reacts in the same way, is a very easy world to manipulate. And there will always be those who want to silence us when we say something different, or hide us if we don't conform to their standards. And there will always be those who want to control what we learn and what we read and what we watch on television. We have to watch out for them, and we can't let them win. Without our individuality, we are nothing. Sure, it causes problems, but it also solves them. I honestly believe that if there is any purpose whatsoever in the existence of the human race, then that purpose is for us to learn how to use our individuality to prevent destructive conflict rather than initiate it. I think we've made a pretty good start here at Stony Brook. In fact, maybe we just might be able to teach the real world a thing or two in this field. Well, there was so much to do here on this campus, yet so few of us had the time to break away from whatever it was we were engrossed in order to try something new. And this is unfortunate, because the whole purpose of a university is to expand the mind. There are too many who come to places like Stony Brook knowing exactly what it is they want and seeking to extract only the knowledge that they find relevant, or worse, only the knowledge that they feel will be useful to them later in life. But how do we know what knowledge will be beneficial if we don't take a sampling of the many different forms in which it can be found? It's not unlike a large menu from which we choose our courses. If we keep picking the same thing over and over again, we'll be missing so much. There's a great deal of knowledge and experience that I know I missed out on here. I don't think a single member of this or any other class can say they've gotten every conceivable thing they could have possibly gotten out of their education. But I do know there's a great deal more that I would have missed had I not decided to branch out, experiment, try something new. Some of the most valuable moments for me at Stony Brook came from courses not connected with my major. As a result, I know I'm not the same person I was when I came here for the first time, not knowing what to expect. Life is kind of like this, too. We can fall into a predictable, repetitive routine, work 9 to 5 every day, watch primetime TV every night, or we can keep our eyes open, continually searching for something more. We can communicate only with those who share our thoughts and feelings, or we can expand and include people from diverse backgrounds who have had entirely different experiences in life. We can play it safe, remain the same, and learn nothing. Or we can expand our knowledge, shed our fears, and try something different. It's a choice that's completely up to us. While parts of us are resistant to change, there's another element that just can't wait to get the whole thing over and done with. We move frantically from year to year, running up the ladder of success without slowing down or stopping for breath. Some can actually survive life at such a pace. Others merely think they can. And when they finally realize that the standards they've set are impossible, their lives become miserable. They consider themselves failures. And they begin to lose their sense of direction and their ability to care. What they don't see, and what many of us haven't learned yet, is that there is no such thing as a complete failure or a complete success. Of all the people gathered here today, every last one will succeed at something, and every last one will fail at something else. There is not one person here who will be successful or unsuccessful at everything they attempt. I know we all have dreams and ambitions, like being dry. Some will come true, others won't. What I'm saying is, when we encounter the latter, it's not the end of the world. Because this world is so large and varied, we can never run out of dreams. I've known people who've come to Stony Brook knowing exactly what it is they wanted. And after a while, they reached the conclusion that it was not quite what they had anticipated. So they embarked on a totally new pursuit and found, much to their amazement, a brand new world within them. One that they probably never would have discovered had they not failed. It takes a lot of guts to do something like that. In the coming years, I hope we will be able to admit it when we've made a mistake or when we find ourselves unhappy. After all, we can't hope to be honest with one another if we're not honest with ourselves. Before I conclude, I'd like to take this moment to pay tribute to those who have helped me survive over the last few years. To my mother and my sister for their patience and inspiration. To my grandparents for their generosity and kindness. And to my friends on and off campus for just being around. I just want to say thanks. So, thanks. One more page and I'm done. You know, it's been said that today's college graduate wants one thing: to make money and get a good job. Well, I don't mind either one. But there is more to life, and I hope we're able to see that in the coming years. The world needs us, desperately. The world needs our ideas, our knowledge, our ingenuity. Our environment is being destroyed. Who will protect it? Educational institutions like this one are being hit with horrendous budget cuts, as are students, the poor, and the elderly. Who will speak for them? And right now, people are starving for food all over the world while the human race spends trillions of dollars on destruction. Who will try to stop this? Maybe it will be us. Maybe we can change the world. But we'll never know if we don't try. And so, we have at last completed the small section of our lives that is supposed to prepare us for the rest of our lives. One of our first lessons will be that we have been living the rest of our lives all along, and that the preparation for life will never cease. While our formal education may in fact be completed, we have really just begun to learn. Thanks. Good luck.
In the interest of you-know-what, I suggest that we thank the Choral Society of the University for their long processional, and please omit their selection and thank them anyway, please. In the rites of commencement, tradition calls for a commencement major speaker. This year, the University Senate Executive Committee and the president agreed that it would be most appropriate to call upon a distinguished member of the university faculty. We thus honor Dr. Louis Kozer, professor of sociology, who is recognized by the State University of New York with the title of distinguished professor. Dr. Kozer is a major figure in his field. His reputation has spread far beyond this university, this state, and this nation. Many of his books have become standard works of reference in the field of sociological theory and political sociology. Past president of the American Sociological Association, the Eastern Sociological Society, the Society for Study of Social Problems, Fulbright Fellow, Guggenheim Fellow, Fellow of the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences, Dr. Kozer's latest honor was announced just 1 week ago. I am thus happy to introduce as our commencement speaker the most recently elected member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, distinguished professor Louis Kozer.
Thank you, Dr. Anderson, for your kind introductory remarks. President Marburger, members of the Stony Brook Council and of the Board of Trustees, members of the faculty, graduating students, invited guests. The customary pattern of commencement addresses requires that the speaker invoke in glowing terms the future career of those who are graduating. As a new generation prepares to enter the world of practical affairs or avails itself of the opportunities offered by graduate training in professional schools, it is customary for the speaker to congratulate them and to paint a rosy picture of what awaits them in the world that they have been sheltered from during their undergraduate years. Commencement addresses speak habitually of the challenges and promises of the new world which the graduating class is now about to enter. I shall depart from this pattern, largely because I firmly believe that a rosy picture would be untrue to the conditions which the class of 1982 is actually going to encounter. Storm clouds rather than sunny days mark the horizon. Promises hardly beckon, and the enemies of promise seem to have taken charge of the period to come. Let me speak of the educational scene first. Ever since the early 60s and until recently, federal concerns with education have been a prime object of national policy. Even if Lyndon B. Johnson may have exaggerated a bit, as he was prone to do, when he said, "The answer for all our national problems comes down to a single world, and that world is education," he nevertheless was correct in pinpointing the high priority that education received by his and all subsequent administrations until the present one. In 1960, $500 million, less than 1% of the federal budget was spent for the schools, and the Office of Education was an insignificant backwater.
In 1980, some $25 billion, more than 5% of the total federal outlays, went to schools and universities. Many impressive achievements in American science and in other areas were made possible by this massive infusion of federal funds. Uncounted numbers of undergraduate and graduate students who could never have financed their studies with private funds were able to complete their studies with the help of this financial aid. They now make an enormously important impact and contribution to the nation's fund of knowledge, to the development of its sciences and technologies, and to our common culture. Now, new educational programs, such as Head Start or Upward Bound, contributed significantly to counteract educational failure among poor students, who could thus enrich the pool of talented young men and women on which the nation can draw. And when it comes to education, the 60s and most of the 70s were golden years, years of exhilarating progress, years of promise, as well as of achievement. But now, the enemies of educational progress are in the ascendancy and threaten to undo much of what has been achieved in the previous two decades. Why that should be is somewhat of a puzzle. The present administration is dominated by economists and politicians who are convinced that what ails America is above all insufficient capital investment. They argue that America has lost much of its industrial lead to other nations who had the foresight to invest more heavily in technological advances, and that only massive tax cuts will motivate those in command of capital resources to invest more heavily in the thoroughly needed revitalization of the infrastructure of the American economy. I have a good deal of trouble with this economic doctrine, but this is not the place to indulge in discussions of economic theories. But what strikes me as truly incomprehensible is that the same Washington, and I should say Albany, decision makers who talk so much of the need to revitalize investments in capital seem to be bent in restricting investments in knowledge and in knowledge producing. While concentrating on the increase in material capital, they seem bent on hampering investment in cultural capital. And yet, how can America be made more productive and better able to withstand foreign competition if it neglects and hampers the production of the knowledge that is indispensable for the future operation of all these new plans and machines that the supply-side economists envisage? Without skilled workers, without skilled technicians, without skilled scientists, material investments will produce no progress and will put us further behind in the race for higher productivity. Yet the Reagan administration seems bent on dismantling educational and training programs. After the Sputnik shock of 1957, we embarked on major efforts to upgrade human skills on the white collar as well as on the blue collar level. But at present, far from concentrating on increasing skills, the administration seems bent on depressing skill levels by restricting educational supports and educational opportunities. Make no mistake about it. As economists like Lester Thoreau have argued, individuals who are not trained still remain part of the society. Not only will they be unable to make a contribution to the nation's welfare, they will constitute a sullen, aggrieved, bitter group of men and women who may become permanently alienated from society. Young men and women who had counted on federal or state funds to pursue their educational careers now suddenly face the prospect of becoming ineligible for support and disappear from the social map. Or are they going to disappear from the social map? They will constitute a kind of social time bomb that may explode with rage and anger sometime in the future. those who were desperately eager to invest in material capital but refused to invest enough in human capital know not what they are doing. They must be reminded of the folly of their ways, lest they plunge the country into decay, decline, and catastrophe. Let me now, in the few minutes that remain, move from the educational scene to the larger scene that we all, young as well as old, face today. We all live in the shadow of the bomb. We all live in an age when, for the first time in the history of humankind, we humans have the capacity to destroy the human species in its entirety. Russia and the United States are, to use Robert Oppenheimer's phrase, like scorpions in a bottle that might well destroy each other and the rest of mankind to boot. The present arms race, when both sides have the means to destroy each other several times over, has created a doomsday atmosphere on this globe that is entirely unprecedented. Plagues and pestilences have often in the past decimated humankind, but these were natural disasters. What we now face is not decimation, but total obliteration, man-made to boot, collective human suicide. Both Russia and the United States are hell-bent on developing ever more powerful, sophisticated, and technologically advanced systems of destruction, each bent on a wholly illusory superiority. And so we starve education while throwing ever-increasing billions into the jaws of the war machine. Each side, of course, sees the other side as evil warmongers, while it conceives itself as being among the children of light. The course to total disaster seems foreordained. Yet, I do not believe that this is indeed the case. We can still stop on the edge of total destruction. I happen to believe that the Russian regime has created a slave state and that it brutally suppresses every attempt at human freedom and dignity, not only within its own boundaries, but also, as the recent tragedy in Poland documents, beyond its borders. Yet those that rule the Kremlin may be wicked, but they are not suicidal. I believe that they are aware of the immense dangers and the immense costs of further escalations of the Cold War. If that is indeed the case, and if those who wish to unleash the dogs of nuclear war can be restrained on both sides, then a window of hope can perhaps be opened on the world scene. I do believe, as Ambassador George Kennan, that sooner or later, and the sooner the better, all the governments on both sides of the East-West division will find themselves compelled to undertake the search for positive alternatives to the insoluble dilemmas which any suicidal form of weaponry presents and can only prevent. What are such alternatives? Agreements to make deep cuts in long-range strategic missilery are possible. A complete denuclearization of Central and Northern Europe is entirely feasible. There could be an agreed total ban on nuclear testing, and at the very least, the antagonists could accept a temporary freeze on further buildups of their nuclear arsenals along the lines recently proposed by Senator Kennedy and his associates. Finally, such distinguished establishment figures as Robert McNamara, McGeorge Bundy, George Kennan, and Gerard Smith recently have suggested that American planners could abandon their previous so-called flexible response theories and instead adopt a no-first-use policy in nuclear weaponry. None of these policies, by the way, involve in any way a unilateral disarmament. All of them would still leave America as well as Russia with ample deterrent forces. But they would at least present a hopeful beginning in the winding down of the process of mutual competitive escalation that could only end in disaster. I find the recent phenomenal growth of the anti-nuclear movement in Europe most heartening. I find it even more heartening that the movement has now spread to the United States. It indicates that ordinary men and women are no longer willing to see themselves as simple victims of the nuclear juggernaut, passive objects of those who direct the war machine. They are now willing, though through protest and agitation, to become acting subjects willing to step into the political arena, which for too long has been dominated by so-called specialists in the arcane science of total destruction. They do not wish their children to be deprived of the chances of life, and they don't wish their civilization destroyed. And they now have made their voices heard, and I wish them good speed ahead. If the dogs of war are forced to retreat, if we gain at least some breathing spell in the mad race towards mutual destruction, we can then again turn toward all these myriads of problems, economic, political, moral, cultural problems, which we have to deal with in order to build a better America. But first, this deadly mortgage has to be lifted. Finally, a few last words about the younger generation, which is about to enter the public scene in America. This generation has been accused of being narcissistic, of caring only for materialistic values, of concentrating on feathering their own nests. These, I believe, are largely unjustified accusations. I believe that there are enormous sources of idealism, devotion to the common weal, and potentials for committed action among the young today. Just as they were present in an earlier generation that served in the Youth Corps or stood in the forefront of the battle for civil rights. But these resources must be mobilized. It is not, as tired politicians of both parties have so often made us believe, that the young have failed us. It is rather that we have failed them. When the older generation fails to lead, when it loses the moral stamina to provide goals that can inspire the young, then the new generation must effect the rapid change of the guard. It must provide new moral leadership from its own ranks, and it must mobilize its own energies to battle for new ideals. Let me close with a quote from John Milton. "I cannot praise a fugitive and cloistered virtue, unexercised and unbreathed, that never sallies out and sees her adversary, but slinks out of the race where the immortal garland is to be run for, not without dust and heat." Thank you.
I salute the sodden few who are left. I gather you're all graduate students. Sorry there. Anyway, I had a few niceties about the man I'm about to introduce. You know them already. It's a distinct pleasure to introduce Dr. John Merberger, president of the State University of New York at Stony Brook.
Thank you, Andy. I still think it's a good idea, and we'll try it again next year. In the interests of your health, we are going to truncate this ceremony and proceed to the awarding of the degrees. Now, what we're going to do is ask candidates for degrees to rise, and I'll be asking Provost Neal and Dr. Oakes to name the various degrees. I will make one formal statement, which I ordinarily would have repeated for each different degree, whereupon we will have the oath for those receiving degrees from the health sciences that demand it. And finally, we will recognize the PhD degree recipients, the doctor's degree recipients, but the hooding will be deferred. Hoods will be available in the gymnasium after this ceremony. And then there are some special people, special awards that I would like to recognize, and we will be through. So at this time, allow me to introduce our new provost and chief academic officer of the university, Provost Homer Neal.
Thank you very much, President Marburger. The awarding of degrees to our students holds a special significance for the faculty and academic administration of the university. The successful culmination of years of studies by today's graduates is a source of pride for the entire Stony Brook academic community and for the parents and relatives who have provided the constant support and encouragement that make the special occasion today possible. This event is also a great source of hope for society, which eagerly awaits the contributions these graduates will make to its cultural, economic, sociological, scientific, and technological advancement. I would now like to ask all of the recipients for the bachelor's and master's degrees for the main campus schools to please rise.
By virtue of the authority vested in me by the Board of Trustees and upon the recommendation of the faculty, I confer upon you who have completed the respective requirements for your respective degrees, the degrees to which you are rightfully entitled, with all the rights, privileges, and responsibilities pertaining thereto. Congratulations and thanks for staying. Please be seated.
I would like now to call on Dr. Howard Oakes to introduce the candidates from the health sciences.
Would the deans of the health sciences center schools and the candidates for the degree please rise? Mr. President, I have the honor to present these candidates for the degrees Bachelor of Science in Allied Health, Nursing, Social Welfare, Master of Science in Allied Health, Master of Science in Social Work, Doctor of Medicine, and Doctor of Dental Medicine.
Thank you. By virtue of the authority vested in me by the Board of Trustees and upon the recommendation of your faculty, I confer upon all of you who have completed your requirements